pop culture, and current events all come together. Cutting-edge topics.
My point is not that we don't pursue holiness, but that there's more to sin than just immorality.
Truth for the now generation. Guests who push your hot button.
You got guys like this guy just saying, oh, well, we'll just live in sin and grace may abound. Mm-hmm. I don't think so, friend.
Relevant, real radio. Confronting the culture.
So if you tell me something that's not true, that's a lie. But you didn't lie because that was from your head, not your heart. So you didn't sin.
This is Truth Talk. Live now from the Truth Booth, your host, Dr. Alex McFarland.
Did Jesus Christ physically rise from the grave? Did Jesus really come back from the dead? And is there evidence for that? Is there ancient evidence for the life of Christ? Well, today on Truth Talk Live, we will hear about this subject from an expert. Truly an expert. His name is Gary Habermas. He's the author of numerous books, well-known Christian apologist, scholar, and author. He's our guest on Truth Talk Live. Welcome to the program. This is Alex McFarland, your guest host today. And, you know, when I think about Dr. Habermas, I think about a quote by Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln said this. He said, if I had 8 hours in which to chop down a tree, I would invest 6 of them sharpening my axe. Well, Dr. Habermas is one of the most popular speakers that we've ever had at the National Conference on Christian Apologetics. We use him at the Focus on the Family Big Dig Teen Apologetics event. And he's touched countless lives around the world, my own included. And he's going to be our guest in just a minute. I want to say welcome to listeners everywhere. I just got in from Spokane, Washington, where there were hundreds of young people just zealously studying to defend their faith. And so, folks, if you are not up to speed on apologetics, it's just one of the fastest growing segments of ministry, because apologetics says, here is what we believe, here's why we believe it. And for listeners wherever you are, if you are a person who's got questions or spiritual doubts, I would say that there are compelling lines of evidence in favor of the Christian faith. But a person who can say it far more persuasively and with more experience than I is our guest. Dr. Gary Habermas earned his PhD at Michigan State. For a number of years, he's been Distinguished Chair of Apologetics and Philosophy at Liberty University. He's adjunct at schools all around the world. He's written numbers of books. The one that I delight to recommend every time I'm on a university campus, The Historical Jesus, Ancient Evidence for the Life of Christ, which I have a few testimonies of students who have read this book once I recommended it, and they became convinced of the authenticity of the Gospels and gave their life to Christ, all a result of the great and pervasive ministry of this man, our guest today, Gary Habermas. Welcome to Truth Talk Live.
Alex, I'm glad to be here with you. Always glad to hear from you.
Hey, man, I appreciate you taking time to be on the show. Just give us an update on what's going on in your life and world, and then I want to talk about some of the things in the news relevant to the historicity of the Gospels. But what's going on? Summer's over. You're probably back in class. But where you been? What are you doing, Dr. Habermas?
Well, I had a couple trips to Oxford University in late spring and then again in the summer, and I've taught some courses here and there. I'm getting ready to teach a PhD course at Liberty University here in just a few weeks on the subject of New Atheism. So that and a bunch of publishing deadlines have occupied just about every second of my time.
Well, speaking of the New Atheism, 25 years ago, when, you know, I've got one of your books in my hand right now, The Resurrection of Jesus, the University of America Press. I mean, when you were, you know, first, you know, getting on the national scene in the 80s, and you were debating Anthony Flew and things like that, did you really think that there would ever be a resurgence of atheism?
That's a great question. And if I did, would it be this kind? Would it be the species that we see today? So let me twist your question a little bit this way. No, I didn't think we'd be seeing a resurgence of the type of atheism we're seeing today. I'll put it this way. Someone asked me the other day, what's the difference between the new atheism and the old atheism? A friend of mine recently wrote an essay on why he likes the old atheists. And I defined it...
Well, what are the... Tell me this. What are the differences?
Well,
Isn't atheism just atheism?
I define it like this. It's really hard to put your finger on it. But when the fellow asked me, what's the difference between the old atheism and the new atheism, I just kind of made a smart aleck comment that I'm not sure is terribly far from the difference. I said, the new atheism is old atheism that's really angry. Or it's the old, it's old atheists that are, on the one hand, not just angrier, but willing to speak out, to put down, and to kind of hammer. I'll say one other thing. I think the new atheists are not anywhere near as well grounded as the old atheists in the appropriate atheist philosophy and responses, and et cetera. So I guess if I put that all together, I'd say two things. The new atheists are not as deep philosophically as the old atheists, but they're angrier for sure. They're quicker on the draw. They're more willing to go on talk shows and decry Christianity and other religions.
It sounds like they've exchanged some substance for emotion.
You could say it that way. I've even said, I know this won't make them happy, but I have even said that the new atheists are a mile wide and a few inches deep. Whereas the old atheists, let's say, were not as wide and a lot deeper. I'll say something else. The new atheists are much easier targets than the old atheists. So if that's my...
Really?
Yeah, I think if that's my ground, if I want to say something like, well, I'd like more chances to speak publicly, then I guess I would be happy for the new atheists because they've brought religion into the public arena, onto our major talk programs, onto our major university campuses. That makes people call me up and many other people up, yourself included. That makes them call us up and say, hey, what do you all say about this? And we're given venues and airtime that we would not otherwise be given. And when you combine that with the fact that I think their arguments are not anywhere near as strong as the last generation of atheists, I think the opportunities can be seen as wonderful. How's that?
Well, you know, I think, yeah, one of the big stories of recent years, I mean, one of the most well-known philosophical atheists of our lifetime, Anthony Flew, who
right.
you debated in the 1980s, and you recently interviewed again on your website. And folks, I want to plug his website, which is what, Dr. Habermas?
www.GaryHabermas.com. That's simple. H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S, GaryHabermas.com. And I'll just say briefly, there's a lot of material on the historical Jesus, the resurrection, a bunch of debates, but nothing is for sale. Everything is free to listen to and to watch and so on.
And you've got a recent interview between yourself and Anthony Flew up there too, right?
I have several dialogues with him. I'm not sure. I have two recent interviews with him, and I'm just getting permission to put one of them on my website. The other one just came out with InterVarsity Books just about a month ago. So there are several items with Tony up there. In fact, our last debate, we've debated three times, our last debate that was hitherto unpublished, it happened back in 2003, that has just been placed under contract with InterVarsity Publishers. That should be out perhaps within a year.
You're listening to Truth Talk Live. This is Alex McFarland, your guest host, coming to you from Southern Evangelical Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. Our guest today is Gary Habermas. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk to Dr. Habermas about the resurrection of Christ, ancient evidence for the life of Christ, and also something called the Gabriel vision. He will be one of our keynote speakers at the National Conference on Christian Apologetics, November 7 and 8, along with James Dobson, Josh McDowell, Chuck Colson, Lee Strobel, Hank Hanegraaff, Erwin Lutzer, Del Tackett from Focus on the Family's Truth Project, William Dembski, many more. And so, folks, the website for the conference, you can see and hear Dr. Habermas in person, nationalapologeticsconference.com. Now, we've had 30 people today register. It's going to sell out. It's 2 months away, but you better hurry because the National Apologetics Conference is always, always drawing thousands of people from all 50 states and beyond. We have a teen track And so you don't want to miss this special, special event. And also it will include a debate, a live debate, between Dinesh D'Souza, representing Christianity, and atheist Michael Shermer, who was prominently featured in the movie Expelled. NationalApologeticsConference.com. It's an annual event, and it's a special event. Part of it is very special to us because every year we see people come to Christ at this event after having heard the evidence for God, the Bible, and Christianity. Hey, we got a break. Alex McFarland will be back after this, and our guest, Dr. Gary Habermas, on the resurrection. Did Jesus rise? Find out the evidence when we come back.
Truth Talk Live.
We're back on Truth Talk Live. Our guest gets around the world, highly in demand as a speaker and presenter, debater. Dr. Habermas, you were in a couple of debates this year in Europe, right?
Yes, in England, right. One in Scotland, the University of Edinburgh, one in England at Cambridge, and another one in Birmingham, England.
Before the break, we were talking about, and time fleets away, so I want to make the best use of it, but let's just basically talk about the resurrection. Whether Jesus physically rose or whether he maybe was, you know, some type of spiritual being that came out of the grave as just a non-corporeal being, or whether his followers had an hallucination. I mean, why does it really matter?
Well, it matters because I think we would like to consider that our most cherished beliefs are grounded in reality. I mean, for example, take maybe the biggest question we'll ever ask, is there an afterlife? It would seem to me to be very, very important to know if I'm on the right side of the street, so to speak. I want to first know there is an afterlife, and if I'm satisfied that there is one, then I want to ask, what kind? Who's correct? What ought I to be doing in this world? And then, secondly, if I think there is an afterlife and that I can do something in this world, then I wonder how can that newfound belief affect my world? All of that, every ounce of that, depends on whether it's true or false. If it's nothing more than a dream, a wish fulfillment, then I question all of my religious and ethical activity in my life.
But for these ultimate questions, can we really know?
Yes, I think we can. And the way I go after the whole thing I just outlined, and the way I did many, many years ago when I went through 10 years of skepticism and actually came very close to becoming a Buddhist, I think the way I went after it in those days was the same way I do today, and that is to ask the question, on what can I build a case for the resurrection? And I thought, well, if I can build a case on the skeptical data, i.e. the data that agnostics, skeptics, even atheists would concede, then that would be a firm foundation indeed. And so what I did was set out to argue a case for the resurrection based on the critics' data. And I'm more firmly convinced today than I've ever been in my life that the resurrection of Jesus can be established based on the critics' data. So if the believers' data is right, then we are far better off.
Well, based on that's a vital point. They're based on the critics' data. I know when you spoke at the conference last year, you mentioned critical scholars, and that's a very important thing to point out. So elaborate on that, would you?
Well, what I'll do is I'll say, if the Bible's inspired, Jesus is raised from the dead. If the Bible is not inspired, but it's just a good history book, it's highly reliable, Jesus is still raised from the dead. But if for some reason the Bible is not inspired and not reliable, if all it is a book of ancient literature, mankind's highest aspirations, reaching for God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or something like that, there are still facts in that book, just like there are facts in Homer's Iliad or Homer's Odyssey, there would still be facts in the New Testament. Well, critics accept a minority of New Testament data, and they reject the majority of New Testament. My point is, we can take that minority alone and build not just any old case for the resurrection, but the best case for the resurrection based on the things that even skeptics think we can know about the New Testament. So the basis would be a narrower, harder, more refined case, and hence I think a much stronger argument for the resurrection.
Well, even based on critics' conclusions, I mean, what can we know about Jesus Christ?
Well, I mean, critics will say things like this. Jesus died by crucifixion. Contrary to popular belief, that's almost never questioned by scholars. I'm talking about scholars here, not what somebody in the street who is skeptical but doesn't know what skeptical scholarship believes. They would concede almost without hesitating that Jesus died on the cross. They would concede
even skeptical scholars.
By far. I've counted. I've done a head count on scholars from 1975 to the present in several languages. And you can name the scholars who would question Jesus' death on the cross on one or two hands. That's over 30 years of research. So there's almost no one that questions that out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, actually a few thousand published sources. Then they will concede probably the key event that everybody will grant you besides the death of Jesus is that the earliest Christians thought they saw the risen Jesus. They thought they saw the risen Jesus. So building on that, that the risen Jesus was believed to have been seen, then you have to start asking questions like, well, if there was no resurrection, what else could have happened? And no matter what hypothesis you come up with, it is going to run up against all of these dozen or just a mere dozen or two dozen facts that critics will allow. You could rule out every other hypothesis except for the resurrection. And that, by the way, is why critical scholars will almost never take other alternative views to the resurrection.
So what do they say is the, what happened here?
Probably by far the most common response today goes something like this. Jesus died, and his disciples thought they saw him again later. I don't know any reason why they wouldn't have seen him, but, you know, I'm not as positive as you are as to what they did see, so they had real experiences, let's just leave it right there. And that's where they let the case sit. They leave it with a just kind of a question mark.
No real conclusion.
As opposed to saying something specific. They're satisfied to leave it sit at the place where Jesus really died, and the disciples thought they saw him. They'll even concede that there were critics, like the Apostle Paul and James, who were unbelievers until they saw the risen Jesus. They will concede that those unbelievers also became Christians when they thought they saw the risen Jesus. They'll concede that this report goes all the way back to the cross, not decades later when the Gospels were written. They'll concede that it was there from the very beginning. The scholars who really know what they're talking about, the skeptics, and the atheists who teach in the universities who specialize in this, yes, they will concede all of that. And probably the worst most of them get is to say, I don't know what to say about this. That's probably the most negative they get. There are some
For Talk Around the Water Cooler tomorrow, give the listeners the top three things to say. If somebody says, how do I know Christ rose from the grave? Give me your top three reasons.
I would say there is hardly a scholar in the world who does not think that the earliest disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus. Okay, so the first point is that the early disciples thought they saw the risen Jesus. I'd say a second point is that there's no way to explain that away using the data we have. And so what we're left with is a resurrection. And then you have the questions I raised earlier about an afterlife, and I think that's very important.
Hey, we've got a break. After this, Richard Howe and your calls on Truth Talk Live.
If everybody had a nose across the USA, then everybody'd be served.
Oh, don't you hate it when summer fleets away and you make one last trip to the beach? Well, time is fleeting away because it's less than 2 months to the National Conference on Christian Apologetics, hosted every year by Southern Evangelical Seminary. Yours truly, Alex McFarland, back. And I'm so excited here because not only is the man in the studio with me now, he'll be one of the speakers at the National Conference on Christian Apologetics, but he's also one of our most beloved professors here at the seminary. Dr. Richard Howe has a PhD in philosophy, and he's written, he's spoken. The students love him. He holds the Norman L. Geisler Chair of Apologetics here at SES. And right now, I want him to be our guest for the second half of the show. We're also going to take calls. If you've got a call, a question, 866-34-TRUTH, if it's apologetics, biblical worldview, philosophy, or just where to get some of the CDs of the oldies that we play on Truth Talk Live, you can call in, 866-34-TRUTH. But Dr. Howe, thanks for being on the program with me.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you. What are you teaching this fall?
I'm teaching five courses this fall. I've got World Religions. I'm teaching a course called Other Religions, and then each time that course is taught, you can get specific in a different religion. So this semester, we're looking at Contemporary Occultism.
Oh, wow.
Which is very interesting. Doing a history of philosophy, doing a couple of PhD courses in philosophical apologetics and apologetic systems. So
what led you to be a professor?
You know, it's funny. I, early on after I got saved, I had a yearning to do ministry. And about at the same time, I knew that ministry wasn't going to be the pastorate.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I had an uncalling to be in the pastorate.
Right.
So I didn't really know there was a such thing as academic ministry of any sort. And so I sort of backed into it because when I went away to college, having been saved only about 3 years, I was not prepared for the theological liberalism that I encountered. I went to a denominational school of my own denomination,
mm-hmm.
and I lost my faith while I was in college. And I don't believe you can lose your eternal life,
mm-hmm.
but you can lose a lot of other things. And I was very stumbled by professors who had, you know, PhDs, and they were from my denomination, and they were Christians, but they were skeptics about the reliability of the Bible and various aspects of theological truth. And so that stumbled me as a Christian. And God began to bring into my life apologists. Mm-hmm. I don't think I even knew what that word was, but people like Josh McDowell or Norman
sure.
Geisler or R.C. Sproul, and they helped me piece back together what I believed before, but I was beginning to learn why I believe that, and that's what gave me the love for apologetics, and then opportunities began to present themselves to teach in the subject, and I can't believe I get paid to do this.
Yeah, and, well, you know, I meet people across the country who either came to faith or came back to the faith through apologetics.
Well, it's funny because usually people, even those who traffic in apologetics, you immediately think of the application of apologetics to the lost
mm-hmm.
and defending the faith against the skeptics. But I think a lot of people might be surprised to see how often apologetics ministers to somebody who's already a believer, where they need their faith shored up because they've either, through their own reflection or encountering skeptics, begin to doubt some things. And that's a scary experience, and so that's exactly what happened to me. So apologetics, I think, is just as legitimate an enterprise directed to other Christians as it can be to the non-Christian.
What are some of the big issues? I mean, what are some of the key things that apologetics speaks to?
Well, I mean, you know, you name any, virtually any aspect of the Christian faith that intersects with the real world that's not just unique to Christianity. What I mean by that is there are a lot of theological issues that Christians can talk about and perhaps even disagree over that fall beyond the boundaries of what apologetics can do. So apologetics is not something that can settle issues like, well, are we predestined or do we have free will or should we sprinkle or should we immerse? Should there be Presbyterian or some ecclesiology? Those sort of internal family disputes are important, but those are more theological. Where apologetics comes into play are issues that where we can intersect with the lost. Is there a God? What is he like? You know, how did the universe come about? Has it always existed? Who is Jesus? How do we know that the Bible is his word? Those sort of big questions that draw most distinctly the distinction between the Christian view of reality and other views of reality.
We've got a couple of callers, and for those just tuning in, we are this is Truth Talk Live. Alex McFarland, the guest in our first hour, Dr. Gary Habermas, well-known author and expert on the resurrection of Christ. He will be a keynote speaker at the National Conference on Apologetics, November 7 and 8, 2008. It's $75 for a two-day event that includes Josh McDowell, Chuck Colson, Lee Strobel, Erwin Lutzer, Hank Hanegraaff, David Noble, Dr. Habermas, William Dembski to speak on intelligent design, and Dr. James Dobson, many, many more speakers. There are sessions for teens and adults. Folks, I want to challenge you to posture your church to reach and disciple more people in the next 12 months through apologetics. And also, folks, just as an individual, it will take your walk to the next level. The event will conclude with a debate between Dinesh D'Souza, author of a best-selling book called What's So Great About Christianity, and atheist Michael Shermer. It's the National Conference on Christian Apologetics. Dr. Howe, additionally, will be speaking. The website for the conference is nationalapologeticsconference.com. That's a mouthful, but a little bit shorter, the website for our school. And for those who are listening across the country and internationally, you can begin today to earn your degree, bachelor's, master's, doctoral level degree in church ministries, apologetics, Christian education, through ses.edu, a fully accredited external program. And one of your professors, should you enroll, will be our guest, Dr. Richard Howe. Dr. Howe, there are so many things to talk about, calls we're going to take in just a moment. I know we have several callers holding, but what does the Bible have to say about our brain? I mean, we say, well, you know, I gave my heart to Jesus, end of story.
Well, yeah, you know, one of the commandments of Jesus that perhaps isn't the first one that comes to mind when people think about commands from Jesus is a command that says, love your God with all your mind. And so while there are other aspects of our relationship with God besides our mind, that is an aspect, I think, that has been overlooked, especially in American Christianity, for the better part of the last century and a half, perhaps. And I think through a lot of interesting intersections of philosophy and other social forces in America, we've really bred generations that have not only become non-academic or non-intellectual, but almost anti-intellectual, where people think that their faith is comprised exclusively of some type of religious experience. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to denigrate the legitimacy. Obviously, if you don't have an experience with the Lord, you don't know the Lord. But a lot of times what has happened is that experience has sort of run the train, if you will. And so the mind has been put on hold, if not completely shut off. So I think that what we've tried to do here at SES is to sound the clarion call to the Christian community to wake up their minds and begin to think about their faith and how we can know these things are true and challenge the institutions in our culture intellectually for the truth of the Christian faith.
We've got a caller from St. Louis graciously holding for a good part of the show. Joseph, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Hey, I just want to say I love apologetics, but... I thought you said that you taught at Liberty University. I'm sorry, I guess I misunderstood that.
Dr. Habermas.
Yeah, yeah.
That was the previous guest.
Oh, is that a previous guest? Okay, well, I love apologetics. Can you answer one thing for me? In early Earth creation, light travels at a certain speed. Why is that not a relatively easy question? How would you answer that?
What? Help me understand exactly what is the question?
Okay, early creation, we believe that as Christians, about 7,000 years, thick, somewhere in there, that Earth has only been around, the creation of the universe, biblically speaking. Now, we know that light travels at a certain speed. Why is the distance between the furthest to now, why are we not seeing an illusion? What is the actual correct answer to that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Of course, Christians who have the highest regard for the integrity and authority of the scriptures have disagreed over the question of the age of the earth. And as far as I know, and I'm not an astrophysicist, as far as I know, all sides agree on what the data is. It's just a matter of trying to figure out how to interpret the data. And so some would argue that given the fact that we see, for example, objects away from the earth at a certain distance and then calculating how far away they are at the known speed of light, then if we're seeing that object, it must have existed X number of years ago for the light to have left the object, and therefore the universe must be at least that old. That's sort of the argument. And there are some responses that others have made, including the fact that I don't necessarily hold this, but some would say, well, you know, maybe God created these objects as far away as they are, but he created the light in between the object and the earth, to which some people say, well, that seems kind of deceptive. Others have argued, interestingly, an astronomer named Halton Arp at Caltech, who's not even a Christian, and as far as I know, is probably not a young earther, he tried to argue that a lot of these red shift objects like quasars weren't nearly as far away as we thought they were. Very interesting prospect.
We've got a break. You're listening to Truth Talk Live. When we come back, we'll take your calls with our guest, Dr. Richard Howe.
Truth Talk Live.
Theology is good, clean, fun. You're listening to Truth Talk Live. Alex McFarland here, and the number is 866-34-TRUTH. This is Elizabeth, graciously holding, and on the screen it says, has really great questions. Elizabeth, thanks for holding.
Hello?
Hi, are you there?
Yes.
Hey, thank you very much for holding. The engineer typed in on my laptop, has really great questions. So what's your question for Dr. Howe?
I don't know how great they are. I'm new to apologetics. I'm just hearing about it, even though I've been a Christian all my life. So the other thing is I'm also a new homeschooling mom, and I'm hoping that I can, that he could recommend some curriculum out there where I can teach my children about apologetics while at the same time not knowing about them, that, you know, I can learn from it. Is there information for beginners and at a younger age level?
Yeah, this is a great issue. It's a need that people started to see needed to be addressed in the past few years only, where we started seeing a lot of material being written for adults, but there was very few things being written for like high school or even younger young people. And so now I can't think of any specifics off the top of my head. I know one of our graduates who's now in apologetics ministry out of California, a man named Joseph Holden, I think has done some writing for teens. And so I don't know if Dr. McFarland can think of any. I do think, though, I've heard recently of some people through the Southern Baptist Convention who have been working on high school curriculum for apologetics. But I'm sorry, I can't think of anything specifically.
You know, there's Focus on the Family has something called the Truth Project College Bound, and it's a worldview curriculum that is kind of a, if you will, a junior version of what Dr. Del Tackett is doing with the Truth Project. And so I would encourage you to go to family.org. But it is really growing, and I want to commend you for homeschooling your kids and teaching them truth, specifically worldview and apologetics truth. Great stuff. Hey, time fleets away. We've got Mark from South Carolina. Thank you, Elizabeth. Mark from South Carolina holding a long time, graciously waiting. Tell us your question, and we might have to go to break, but when we come back, we'll answer it in completion. Mark, thanks for holding.
Yes, thank you. My question is, there's obviously a distinction between classical apologetics and presuppositional apologetics, and I've heard some people argue strongly to use one or the other. But my question for your guest is, really, in this postmodern context, is one better to use than the other?
Well, I had to admit that I'm quite biased with respect to this question. I'm an ardent defender of the classical approach. I have great respect for people who have been proponents of presuppositionalism, and I actually am teaching a course this semester at the PhD level on apologetic systems, which analyzes the various approaches, including both presuppositional and classical. So I cast my lot with the classical method.
And when we come back, we're going to explain exactly what those different terms mean on Truth Talk Live. Stay with us, because after this, we'll be right back for the final session. Hey, we're back on Truth Talk Live. Alex McFarland. For those that live in the Portland area, you can go to my website, and I'm going to be in Portland Friday through Sunday speaking to teens and youth group leaders about worldview and apologetics. Hope to see some Truth Talk Live listeners there. Dr. Howe, before the break, the college question dealt with some of the different approaches to apologetics. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Just for those that may not have known, define presuppositionalism, classical apologetics, evidential. What are the differences?
Well, basically what it's going to involve is the how legitimate and to what extent we think we can use the powers of reason, logic, and critical thinking to address some of these cosmic questions like the existence of God. And generally the classical position puts more stock in the legitimacy of argument and reason, to put it in theological categories, the legitimacy of natural theology, mm-hmm. that God can be known through his creation, that Romans chapter 1, verse 18 and following, the invisible things of God are clearly seen through the things that are made. Psalm 19, 1, the heavens declare the glory of God. So the classical approach says we can take the truths of creation that are fairly undisputed between us and the lost man, that we both know there's a universe, we mm-hmm. both can see the data, and we appeal to that common experience of reality to try to build an argument that there must be the God of the Bible.
Yeah, and we live in a rational world. I mean, we live in a world that can be touched and investigated, and the good Lord gave us reasonable faculties to interpret.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what the classical approach is trying to emphasize. And presuppositionalism has a different way in which they think these things are stacked up, and by the name, it has something to do with the fact that a great amount, if not the entire Christian worldview, has to be the starting point of all reason, that you can't get from the lost state of just critical thinking and arrive at the truths of the Christian faith. And I happen to disagree with that. And I don't mean to oversimplify the presuppositionalist view. It can be complex sometimes, but I think that they tend to put virtually no stock in legitimacy of natural theology and the role of logic and reason and argumentation to establish fundamental truths like the existence of God.
Well, there are some people, I believe, well-intentioned and people that love the Lord, but they say, well, you know, Christianity is not about evidence and data, and it's not about reasoning. It's about relationships and feelings, and it's emotional, not cognitive. What do you say to that mindset?
Well, I would say that it is emotional, but it's not that it's emotional and not cognitive. I mean, if someone is has a relationship with his wife, we celebrate the fact that there's a lot of romance that goes on in a marriage. But he needs to make sure that the woman that he's having these relationships with is really his wife. I mean, if he's lying in the hospital and a woman comes in and says, hey, I'm your wife, give me your love, if he doesn't know whether that's his wife or not, he may need argument and evidence to prove that this woman is really his wife. Now, once he knows she's his wife, then he's responsible to love her.
You've been listening to Truth Talk Live. Our guest in the second half has been Richard Howe. Our first segment, we had Gary Habermas. Both will be speakers at the National Conference on Apologetics, November 7 and 8. Thanks for listening. Stay with us, because we'll be back next time.
This is the Truth Radio Network.